The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Brad McDonald, and I'll be taking Stephen Flurry's seat today here in the Trumpet Daily studio at Edstone. It's good to be back with you all. It feels like a million years since I've done a Trumpet Daily radio program. I haven't been in the studio down here since Sam and Richard made a few updates over the winter break, so I'm really enjoying the cappuccino machine and the massage chair, the 60-inch television, the donuts. I think there's a manicurist out there, so we can get our feet done later on. I'm kidding. It's just a simple room with a table and a few curtains. Well, I'm excited about the program today. I thought later on we could try do something a little new. I don't think it's ever been done before on a Trumpet Daily radio program. Is that right, Sam? Yeah, it's never been done before. So if you hang around for 10 or 15 minutes, you'll be listening to a new feature for the Trumpet Daily radio program. If you'd like to contact us, go ahead and you can always send an email to td@kpcgfm. That's td@kpcgfm. Maybe you are aware of this. Maybe you're not aware of this. Chances are you're probably not aware of it because it just seems like everyone forgets about Australia. But yesterday was Australia Day. January 26th is a national holiday down in Australia. And this is the day that Australians remember and celebrate the settling of Australia by the British in the late 18th century. Yesterday was a public holiday, and pretty much all of the major cities across Australia would have hosted fireworks displays. People would have had a day off work, so they would have gotten together for barbecues. There were probably lots of outdoor concerts. All the good Australian food would have been out, meat pies and chocolate milks and trifles, all those delicious things. It really is a big celebration for Australia, much like July 4th for the Americans. And in today's program, I want to also celebrate Australia, but I want to do it in a different way than people would have done it yesterday. There is a lot to celebrate about my homeland, about Australia. There's a lot to appreciate. Australia has made some wonderful contributions to the world over the past 200 odd years. It's been a critical part of the British Empire. Our natural resources, our mineral wealth has been pivotal to all of the industrial nations. We've contributed as one of the main food producers in the world. Our soldiers were among the most brave. It was known that the soldiers from Australia and New Zealand were the bravest and the toughest in the horrible battles of World War I and II. So there's a lot to celebrate about this great nation. But in today's program, I wanted to celebrate Australia for another reason. I want to celebrate Australia in today's program as fulfillment of one of the greatest prophecies in the Bible. Australia is fulfillment of one of the greatest prophecies in the Bible. And I think as the world celebrates Australia Day, this is what is most important, or this is the most important part or facet of Australia's history that we should consider and celebrate. And I would, I'd bet my left leg that a single commentator in Australia or anywhere else in the world yesterday recognized Australia as fulfillment of Bible prophecy, recognized the founding and settling of Australia as an act of divine providence, recognizing Australia, the settling of Australia by the British as being orchestrated by a supreme planner. Most people in this world probably don't think of God as being involved in the planet's geography. They don't think about God as being involved in where different races settled over the years. They don't think about God being involved in international relations and as I said, the settlement of different peoples over the four corners of the earth. But the Bible very clearly teaches that God is intimately involved in the settlement of nations. And God was involved and he inspired and he orchestrated the settlement of Australia by the British. There's just a couple of scriptures here to kick this off. In Acts 17 and verse 25, it says, and I'll just read from the Revised Standard Version. It says, from one ancestor, God made all nations to inhabit the whole world, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live. It's a great scripture. That scripture should be mentioned and emphasized in the first lecture of every international relations class in every university around the world. International relations is the study of communication between nations, relationships between countries. It's the study of geography, really. And like it said, like Paul says here, I think it was in Acts, God allotted the times of their existence. So when nations would rise and fall, the waxing and waning of different empires, God, he allotted that, or he allowed that. He made sure it unfolded according to his will. And then as it says here, God also orchestrated and sanctioned the boundaries of the nations. The Chinese are in China because God put them there, because that was God's will. It didn't happen willy-nilly. It didn't happen accidentally. Just a quick scripture from Psalm 33. Psalm 33, verses 10 through 15. It says, let the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. The Lord foils the plans of nations. He thwarts the purposes of the peoples. From heaven, the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place, he watches all who live on earth. He forms the hearts of all who considers everything they do. God is involved in the affairs of men. God sees everything, and God even sanctions where races of people can set up shop, where races of people can settle, where a tribe can settle and then grow into a nation. And that's certainly the case with the settling of Australia. God was behind Australia being settled by the English. He was behind. He orchestrated all of those events. And when you go back and look at some of the history surrounding Australia's establishment as a colony of Britain, it really is pretty remarkable. One thing that most people probably don't know is that before it was called Australia, Australia was first known as New Holland. New Holland. And it was given this name by a famous Dutch explorer. And his name was Abel Tasman. He was sailing down there in the Southern Hemisphere, and he saw Australia and he saw New Zealand in the mid-17th century. So in the 1600s, I think it was 1642, Abel Tasman, this Dutch explorer, was in the Southern Hemisphere, and he named Australia New Holland. In his mind, he thought that it was inevitable that the Dutch would come over and settle in Australia. He obviously documented what he saw, and surprisingly, somehow, Australia or New Holland was left alone for more than 100 years. For more than 100 years, the Dutch didn't come back, and no one else, the Belgians, the Dutch, the Spanish, the British, the French, they all had navies at this time, and no one came back to settle in New Holland. It wasn't until just over 100 years later that Australia and New Zealand were settled by the British. How come for 100 years this New Holland just remained free from the Dutch or from anyone else, from any other empire for that matter? In 1770, Captain James Cook, who is one of England's most famous explorers. He discovered Australia and New Zealand, and he made a trip down there to Australia and New Zealand, and he made some maps of the coastline of New Zealand and Eastern Australia. He would stop in at the coast, and he met the Aboriginals and the Maoris, the native peoples of Australia and New Zealand. It was Captain Cook who discovered Botany Bay, which is just south of Sydney, and that's where the first colony started in Australia. So in 1770, Australia was discovered by Captain James Cook. He documented a lot of his findings, and he took that back to England. And about 18 years later, the British established their first settlement in Australia, as I mentioned at the top of the program. In January 1788, the first convoy of ships arrived on the east coast, off the east coast of Australia, just near where Sydney is today. On January 26th, Admiral Arthur Phillip sailed into what today is known as the Sydney Cove. And that's just the famous landmark there is the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and there's the Opera House on the coast there. 200 years ago, obviously, none of that was there. And Admiral Arthur Phillip sailed in with 11 ships with the intended goal of establishing a colony in Australia. He hoisted the British flag, and the rest is history, as they say. Arthur Phillip was the first governor of New South Wales. Now, as most of our listeners know, I'm sure, Admiral Phillips had some pretty unique cargo. He had 11 ships, but his ships were full of convicts. They were full of men and women. I have some figures here later on, but they were full of men and women who had broken the law in England. And England, as you know, is just it's a small piece of territory, and they were running out of room to build prisons. So they were looking for a place to send these convicts. And in 1787, Phillips was given the task of establishing a penal colony in Botany Bay, New South Wales. Now, in 1788, when Phillips arrived, Botany Bay wasn't suitable to establish a colony. So he sailed 5 miles north to Port Jackson, what they called Port Jackson, which today we know as the Sydney Cove, and the city of Sydney grew out of this penal colony established in 1788. This is probably the most recognized facet of Australia's history, the fact that our nation was first settled as a penal colony. That's pretty much for a lot of my friends who I love and adore and I appreciate, this is, most of the time, this is the extent of their knowledge of Australian history. Oh, you guys started as a bunch of prisoners. You guys started as a bunch of thieves and murderers. And it's true. It's true. We did start as a penal colony. Botany Bay was the final destination for England's thieves, murderers, and vagabonds. But I think there's something more to think about here. Just the fact that we started off as a penal colony, in some ways it doesn't even make sense. And then certainly, while Australia may have started as a penal colony, it certainly very rapidly transformed into something much more significant, much more important, and something much more impressive too. So we're going to go ahead now and take a break. When we come back from the break, I want to talk more about this first penal colony and just ask some questions about what was really going on here. But we're going to take a break. Now, instead of going to a commercial, I thought we could play a famous Australian folk song for you. This song is called Botany Bay, and it was it discusses the journey of a convict from England to Australia. No one is certain who the author of this tune is. The song is quite famous now as an Australian folk song. It became well known in 1885, after it was featured in a musical in London. The musical, the title of the musical was Little Jack Shepherd. But listen to the lyrics of this song. The writer really, he invokes some remarkable memories of a convict who was sent from England to the penal colony in Botany Bay, Sydney. And just listen out for just some interesting tidbits of information. So often these folk songs really provide just really enlightening and interesting glimpses into the history of a country and a people, and that's certainly the case here. In the first verse, he says, "Farewell to old England forever. Farewell to the well-known Old Bailey." The Old Bailey was the prison in London. So he says, "Farewell to the well-known Old Bailey." Apparently, this guy had had spent a little bit of time in prison in London. In the fourth verse, where we discover why he was sent to Australia, it says, "These 7 long years I've been serving now, and 7 long more have to stay." So he had a 14-year sentence. "All for bashing a bloke down our alley and taking his ticker away." So apparently he stole a watch and assaulted a guy in a dark alley, and that's why he was in jail. And then in the final verse, he says, "Now all my young dukies and duchesses, take warning from what I've to say. Mind all is your own as you touches, or you'll find yourself in Botany Bay." So he was saying to his children and to all the young people back in England, be careful, don't break the law, or you'll find yourself down here in Botany Bay. So here it is, the quintessentially Australian folk song, Botany Bay.
"Farewell to old England forever. Farewell to my old pals as well. Farewell to the well-known Old Bailey, where I once used to look such a swell. Singing toorally, oorally, andy. Singing toorally, oorally, ay. Singing toorally, oorally, andy. For we're bound for Botany Bay. There's the captain as is our commander. There's the bosun and all the ship's crew. There's the first and the second class passengers. Knows what we poor convicts go through. Singing to rely, rely at a dee. Singing to rely, rely, ay. Singing to rely, rely at a dee. For we're bound for Botany Bay. Tain't leaving old England we cares about. Tain't cause we misspells what we knows. But because all we light-fingered gentry hops around with a log on our toes. Singing to rely, oorally, at a D. Singing to rely, oorally, ay. Singing to rely, oorally, at a D. We're bound for Botany Bay. Oh, had I the wings of a turtle dove, I'd soar on my pinion so high. Slap bang to the arms of my Polly love, and in her sweet presence I'd die. Singing to rely, rely, at a dee. Singing to rely, rely, ay. Singing to rely, rely, at a dee. For we're bound for Botany Bay. Now all my young dukies and duchesses, take a warning from what I've to say. Mind all is your own that you touches, or you'll find us in Botany Bay. Singing to rely, rely, at a dee. Singing to rely, rely, ay. Singing to rely, rely, at a dee. For we're bound for Botany Bay.
Welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed that little folk song, Australian folk song, Botany Bay, the story of a convict sent all the way from England to Australia in the late 18th century. We're talking about the settling of Australia by the British in today's program. Before the break, we noted that Australia was originally settled as a penal colony. It was England's first penal colony in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, something that's interesting to note is that Britain had actually been transporting criminals to its colonies for years, for a few decades, before it sent this first group of convicts to Australia. More than 40,000 convicts had actually been shipped to the American colonies during the 17th century. So to all my American friends out there, you have some convicts in your history too. But it was after Britain lost its American colonies in the late 18th century that it needed another place to send its convicts, and Australia was that place. On the first voyage to Australia, there were 548 male convicts, and there were 188 female convicts. I mean, today I think Australia's population is up to 22 million people. Australia geographically is about the size of the United States. It's a massive country, and today it has a pretty significant population. But the first European arrivals, or the first British arrivals, totaled 548 plus 188, whatever that is, 850. You talk about a grain of mustard seed growing or a peanut shell on the ocean. From less than 1,000 people, this country just grew and grew and grew over the next 200 years to become a first-rate power and an important part of the British Empire. The youngest convict on that first group of 11 ships to Australia, the youngest convict was John Hudson, and he was 9 years old. Little John was a chimney sweep, and he had stolen some clothes and a pistol from a client. And, well, he paid the penalty. This little 9-year-old John Hudson, he stole some clothes and a pistol, and he ended up 16,000 miles away in Australia. The oldest convict in that first convoy of ships was a woman by the name of Dorothy Hanlon. She was 82 years old, and she was put onto a ship to Australia after being found guilty of perjury. So it didn't take much. Usually you had to be a repeat offender, but it didn't take much to find yourself on a ship from England all the way to Botany Bay, Australia. Most of the convicts, actually, that went to Australia were guilty of what today would be considered petty crimes. Stealing a loaf of bread, stealing someone's sheep, stealing someone's clothes, burglary, assault. These were the kinds of crimes that if you committed them, you could end up on a ship on your way to Australia. I mean, today, if you commit these crimes, you know, if someone is found stealing a chocolate bar or a loaf of bread from a store, they're given a slap on the wrist, they're given a tongue lashing, and then they're let go. In 18th century England, these offences got you put on a ship and sent across the ocean to Australia, and you'd probably never return again, or you could return after 7 years or 14 years, whichever sentence you were given. One in 32 convicts at first died just on the journey to Australia. Historian Niall Ferguson, he explores Australia's early history a little in his book Empire. And he talks about the settlement of Australia and the establishment of Australia at first as a penal colony. And he says that establishing a penal colony, or he says that getting rid of the convicts was the prime objective for the establishment of the colony in Australia. And he just, there's a couple of paragraphs here which I'll read to you. He says, the British had been attracted to Asia by trade. They had been attracted to America by land. But there was another continent that was attractive to them for diametrically different reasons, because it was barren, because it was impossibly remote, because it was a natural prison. And then he makes he has a creative connection here. He says, with its weird red earth and its alien flora and fauna, the eucalyptus trees and kangaroos, Australia was the 18th century equivalent of Mars. This helps explain why the first official response to the discovery of New South Wales by Captain James Cook in 1770 was to identify it as the ideal dumping ground for criminals. So this really, you can go back and look at the historical record, and back there in the late 18th century, Britain's leaders, England's leaders really, and its explorers considered Australia as an ideal place as a prison and as an ideal place to send criminals. Now, I've always found that a little odd. I've never been totally convinced. It just seems strange to me that England would send people who would steal sheep or steal clothes or steal a loaf of bread, that they would put them on a ship and send them all the way to Australia. I mean, the journey would take 7 or 8 months. The trip was almost 16,000 miles by sea. It was a dangerous trip, especially around the Cape of Good Hope. There was enormous risk, enormous expense. Why go through all of this risk? Why go through all of this expense just to get rid of convicts, just to get rid of criminals? You know, why send 9-year-old John Hudson to the other side of the earth for stealing a few clothes? Why send 89-year-old Dorothy Handlard to the other side of the earth? Why didn't Britain just send them somewhere else? Maybe somewhere a little bit closer, somewhere where the cost of the journey wouldn't be so expensive. Send them, you know, send the criminals to the Caribbean, or maybe somewhere in Africa. I don't doubt what the historical record says and what historians all write. They all write, and they all recognize that the prime, as Ferguson said, the prime objective for that first colony was to establish a penal colony. The prime objective of England's leader was to set up a penal colony, to establish a place where England could send its criminals. But in some ways, it just doesn't make sense. Something much more significant was happening here, and it was being done in an unusual way. This is not really the way that you would expect a first-rate industrial nation to be established and creative. This is not the way you would expect a sovereign monarchy to grow its empire, to expand its empire into the Southern Hemisphere. But really, when you look back now on 200 years of history, that's what was happening when those 850 convicts arrived in Botany Bay. God was expanding and growing the borders of England. He was expanding and growing the borders of Great Britain. He was creating an empire back there. Now, the English at the time, they weren't thinking about that. Perhaps some were, but for the most part, if you go and search the historical record, they were sending the English to Australia because they needed somewhere to send criminals, and that was it. They were thinking about it practically. They just needed a place to banish naughty people. But God had other plans for Australia. He was laying the foundation of a nation that would quickly become a key member of the British Empire. He was introducing the English to a nation just rich in natural resources, with endless territory to be established and to be built on and developed. And within just a few decades, Australia emerged as just a key part of the British Empire. Here's what Ferguson writes in his book, Empire. He says, "The great paradox of Australian history is that what started out as a colony populated by people whom Britain had thrown out proved to be so loyal to the British Empire for so long. America had begun as a combination of tobacco plantation and Puritan utopia, a creation of economic and religious liberty, and ended up as a rebel republic. Australia started out as a jail, the very negation of liberty. Yet the more reliable colonists turned out to be not the pilgrims, but the prisoners." It's pretty remarkable. And what happened is that Once in Australia, down there in Botany Bay, down there in Sydney, the convicts would come over, and within 10 or 20, 30 years, there were more than 150,000 convicts sent to Australia. But the convicts would be sent to the penal colony in Sydney, in New South Wales, and they would serve their time, either 7 years or 14 years, depending on the nature of their crime. And after they'd served their time, they would be, a lot of them would be given a plot of land, or they'd be able to go out into the economy and get a job. But many of them were given a plot of land, and they, on that land, they built infrastructure, they grew food, they built shops, they cleared the land for building. And over a period of years, more and more infrastructure and developed, and an economy developed, and cities, or I guess they would be towns and villages, and then cities, began to emerge. The colony really thrived under the leadership of a man by the name of Lachlan Macquarie. He was the governor between 1809 and 1821, and he saw Sydney as much more than a penal colony. He saw the potential to really grow what was initially a penal colony into a thriving trading city. And he had huge ambitions. He planned and built masses of homes and buildings and stations. And I mean, he's really one of the great architects of modern day Sydney. He transformed this penal colony into a thriving city and a key port and trade post. A lot of men and women who were sent to Australia originally as a convict went on to become incredibly successful farmers or business owners. And back there in early Australian times, some of the wealthiest and some of the most powerful men in New South Wales actually started out as convicts. It's really a pretty remarkable story. Australia's story it's a remarkable story with virtually no forethought, virtually no detailed planning. A fledgling colony of convicts was transformed into a nation of ambitious, hard-working, rugged men and women with a fierce loyalty to England and to the monarchy. Within a century, Australia had changed from being a pathetic colony of thieves and vagabonds into one of Britain's most important colonies. With a thriving and growing economy, the rule of law was set up. It became a major trading post in the Southern Hemisphere. Australia, Sydney, and then the other cities as they came along became launching pads into Britain's other colonies and assets in the Southern Hemisphere. It was a land with just infinite potential. And it's just remarkable to think that Australia's founding members weren't willfully seeking any of this. That wasn't the plan. As Ferguson said, the prime objective of England's leaders was to just get rid of the criminals, and Australia was a great place to do that. Their prime objective was to find a place to dump convicts. It's pretty remarkable. And then within 100 years, and now 200 and something years later, we have a first-rate industrial power and a vital member of the great British Empire. Okay, we'll go ahead now and take another break. Now, during this break, I thought we would play Australia's national anthem. I love this anthem, obviously, but not just because it stokes my affection for my home country. I love the anthem because of the glimpse that it provides into Australia's history. This anthem is the national anthem of Australia is... It's a history book. It's a chapter in a history book. And it's the same way with most national anthems. A national anthem, it's like a musical photograph, an audio snapshot of a bygone time. In most cases, the national anthem was written when the country was just small and starting out. And when you listen to a lot of the different anthems, there's a sense of destiny, there's a sense of hope there's a recognition in many national anthems, at least in the Western world, certainly with America and Canada and Britain and Australia and New Zealand. There's a recognition of prosperity and wealth, and there's a recognition of a divine role or God's role in that prosperity and wealth. There's often a tone of gratitude and thanks. But a national anthem captures the spirit of a nation. And today, when we listen to the national anthem, it's probably more accurate to say it captures the former spirit of the nation. That's certainly the case with Advance Australia Fair. That's the title of Australia's national anthem, Advance Australia Fair. This song was written in 1878 by Peter Dodds McCormick. He was a Scotsman who settled in Australia. But he wrote Advance Australia Fair after he had attended a concert in Sydney. And at this concert in Sydney in 1878, the choir was singing all the national anthems from countries around the world. And during the concert, McCormack became really aggravated because Australia didn't have its own anthem. At the time, Australia's official anthem was God Save the Queen, England's anthem, obviously. So on the bus ride home, McCormack wrote the first verse of Advance Australia Fair. When he got home, he finished the lyrics and set them to music. Here's what he said in 1913, just about the Australia's national, or the song that became Australia's national anthem. "I tried it over on an instrument the next morning and found it correct. Strange to say, there has not been a note of it altered since. Some alterations have been made in the wording, but the sense is the same. It seemed to me to be like an inspiration, and I wrote the words and music with the greatest ease." So, here it is, Australia's national anthem, Advance Australia Fair. You just have to forgive me a second here while I recover. What a beautiful song. A song celebrating a great nation, and a nation that is great, not because of its beautiful beaches, not because of its material wealth, and a nation great, not because even 100% because of its people. A nation great because its fulfillment of a promise that God made in the Bible. A nation great because God made it great, just like he made America great, just like he made England great, just like he made Canada great and New Zealand's great. So many of these Anglo-American countries that I'm talking about, they were great countries with a lot of material wealth and sophisticated political systems and governments and stable governments. They were nations where the rule of law reigned supreme. They were special nations. I mean, now that is politically incorrect to say today, but historical fact proves it true. They were special nations. But again, why were they so special? Why do we celebrate Australia Day? Why do we celebrate July 4th? Well, I mean, I celebrate it above all as proof of God's existence and proof of God's role in history, God's place in history. We can just, here at the end, I thought we could just review this towering promise that resulted in Australia being settled by the British and going on to become an important part of the empire. And this is a promise that resulted in America becoming the single greatest country on earth. This is a promise that resulted in Canada becoming part of the British Empire and being a nation with just incredible wealth and prosperity. We can go back to Genesis 12. Stephen Flurry has been through these scriptures, and he has pointed you towards our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And everything I'm going to talk about here for the next few minutes comes from The United States and Britain in Prophecy. More than 6 million people have requested that book since it was written by Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And that book is the most important book you could read to inform your understanding of world history and international relations. But that book is really built largely around a promise, or the promise that God made to Abraham here in Genesis 12. So here in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, God says, in verse 1, God tells Abram to get out of the country, and Abraham left. And God says, "And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you and curse him that curses you. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed." As Mr. Armstrong taught us, God makes a twofold promise to Abraham here. The first part of that promise, or in the first part of that promise, God says, "I will make you a great nation." This is a promise of national or material wealth and prosperity and size and accomplishments. It's the promise of race, as Mr. Armstrong put it. And the second part to this great promise is the promise of grace. It says, "And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed." This is the promise of grace, the promise of salvation through Jesus Christ, who was a descendant of Abraham. Now in Genesis 17, that promise, that two-part promise, was conferred onto Isaac, and then it was later conferred onto Jacob, and then it was conferred onto Jacob's grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. In Genesis 22, verses 17 through 18, we see the promise, God's promise to Abraham, being passed on now to Isaac. And it says that, "In blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So as this promise that God made to Abraham is conferred to Abraham's descendants, God gives us more and more details about what this promise would include. In Genesis 35, the promise is conferred to Jacob now, the son of Isaac. Genesis 35, verses 10 through 12 says, "And God said unto him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply." And then notice now, again, this is talking about that promise that God made to Abraham. God says, "A nation and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins." God's incredibly specific here. This promise of material greatness to Abraham would be manifested in the creation of a nation, a single nation, and then a commonwealth of nations, or a company of nations, an empire of nations. It's so specific. It's right here in the Bible, and God repeats it over and over and over. Now, this promise that God made to Abraham really is central to understanding world history. World history is defined by this promise that God made to Abraham and that was conferred to Abraham's descendants. History as we know it really revolves around this promise that God made to Abraham. in the United States and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong then talks about Leviticus chapter 26. He calls this chapter, or I'll just read from the United States and Britain in prophecy. Mr. Armstrong says, "To understand this miraculous burst into world dominance, it is necessary to examine the very pivot of Old Testament prophecies, the 26th chapter of Leviticus." Leviticus 26 is the pivot of Old Testament prophecies. A few pages on, Mr. Armstrong says, "Leviticus 26 is the basic prophecy of the Old Testament. In this central prophecy, God reaffirmed the birthright promise, but with conditions for those of Moses' day." And if you go through and study Leviticus 26, what happens is God says to the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, to Abraham's descendants, God says, okay, I will make good on this promise that I made to your forefather. I will fulfill this promise to Abraham. But he says, here's what you have to do, Israel. And then he specifically in verses 1 through 3 talks about the two test commandments, keeping the Sabbath and Israel not having graven images. Now, what would happen if Israel disobeyed those two commandments? As Mr. Armstrong said, there were conditions to ancient Israel receiving or inheriting this promise that God made to Abraham. What would happen if ancient Israel did not fulfill those conditions? Well, we can see the answer in verses 14 through 18. Verses 14 through 18. In verse 18 there, God says that if Israel breaks the law, then the promise would be delayed seven times. It would be postponed seven times. Now, a time, a time means two things, and Mr. Armstrong explains this in the United States and Britain in Prophecy on page 122. Mr. Armstrong says, the expression seven times is translated into the English from a Hebrew word which conveys a dual meaning. The original Hebrew word Moses wrote is Sheba. It is defined as seven times and also as sevenfold. The seven times implies duration or continuation of punishment. But the word also conveys the meaning of sevenfold or seven times greater intensity of punishment. So time implies duration. And again, you're going to have to get the United States and Britain in Prophecy out and study this. But the math is there, and it's absolutely perfect. But a time in the Bible is 360 years. A time in the Bible is 360 years. And in Leviticus 26, verse 18, God says, now, if you don't fulfill these conditions, or if you don't meet these conditions, Israel, I am going to postpone fulfilling my promise to Abraham for seven times 360 years. And you can do the math if you like, but seven times 360 is 2,520. So God says, Israel, if you don't meet these conditions, I'm going to postpone you inheriting that promise for 2,520 years. This is what Mr. Armstrong wrote in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. There was a condition, a great big if, to their receiving actual fulfillment of this stupendous birthright promise in their time. God said, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season and the land shall yield her increase. So as we look back on the history of ancient Israel, there's a lot to admire about King David and King Solomon and the great empire that Israel became under those two kings. But it's important to remember that as great as Israel became, ancient Israel became under King Solomon, and 1 Kings 10 talks about the kings of the earth coming to admire Solomon and everything God had given him. As great as Israel became, God still hadn't fulfilled the promise he made to Abraham. Now, as you know, Israel disobeyed. Israel broke the Sabbath commandment. Israel had graven images. So God had to postpone fulfilling his promise to Abraham. When did he do that? Well, again, you're going to have to study the United States and Britain in prophecy. But in 721 BC, you can study this history in 2 Kings 17. In 721 BC, God had the Assyrians come and conquer Israel. And all of the Israelites, the 10 tribes of Israel, including Ephraim and Manasseh, the birthright nations, they were picked up and they were taken out of Samaria. And that is the date that we count the 2,520 years from. That's the date we start counting from. And as Mr. Armstrong explains in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, if you count forward 2,520 years from 721 BC, you come to the year 1800, 1801, 1802, 1803. So if we are to believe the Bible, then we can expect around the year 1800 for God to start fulfilling his promise to Abraham, for God to start creating a single great nation, for God to start creating a commonwealth of nations. And you know history. You know what happened around 1800. There's too many incredible historic events to mention, but we've covered one today. In 1788, 12 years before the end of the 2520-year prophecy, in 1788, Australia is settled. And then over the next few decades, it transforms from a pathetic penal colony into this incredibly wealthy, advanced, sophisticated, an important member of the British Empire. It's amazing, right at the end of that 2,520-year prophecy. And if you study history, you can look from one corner of the earth to the other, from Canada down to South Africa, from India to the Caribbean, and you can just see Britain in the late 18th and early 19th century, the empire just growing and growing and growing. And there's colony after colony after colony. And in many cases, it was similar to what happened in Australia. Britain didn't even work that hard for it. It happened almost by accident. In Australia's case, all they wanted to do was purge a few criminals from the country. 100 years later, they've got, you know, a nation that belongs to them, the size geographically of the United States of America. It's amazing. What was going on here? Well, as we've seen today, far more was going on than the mere creation of a penal colony. God was fulfilling his promise to Abraham. 1803, you know what happened to the United States in 1803? Napoleon Bonaparte sells the Louisiana Purchase to, I think it was Thomas Jefferson, wasn't it? Again, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to send 850 convicts all the way to the end of the earth because they've stolen some bread. And it didn't make sense for Napoleon to sell a massive cut of territory for pennies on the dollar to Thomas Jefferson. It didn't make sense. Why would he do that? Well, it's because there's a master planner. It's because there are prophecies in the Bible that God has to make sure are fulfilled. It's because God made a promise to Abraham. And God is a God of his word. He fulfills his promises that he makes to his people. And he made Abraham a promise and he fulfilled it. And for those who are following God today, for those members of God's church today, God's made you promises too. And he'll fulfill that promise just like he fulfilled it to Abraham. So this is just some fantastic history. I'm sorry we had to cover it so quickly. But let's celebrate Australia, not just for its meat pies, not just for its golden beaches, not just for its ruggedly handsome men. Let's celebrate Australia for its remarkable fulfillment of one of the greatest prophecies in the Bible. Good to be with you.